As we kick off the new year, many of us resolve to grow closer to God. But how do we actually do that? Well, we have a resource to help you do just that through our free ebook, 5 Ways to Connect with God. This resource shares 5 simple but powerful spiritual practices to deepen your relationship with God, from cultivating thankfulness to asking God for a word for the year. This guide will help you to find rest, focus, and renewed connection with God as we begin the new year. Download your copy now at premierinsight.org. Start your year off closer to God. That's premierinsight.org. Now, let's get started with today's episode.
Hello, welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brawley, your host for Unbelievable, the programme that brings you conversations that matter every week here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored. Today, a Christian and a non-Christian join me. I'll be introducing them in just a moment's time. And if you want more conversations that help you to think through your faith, or if you're not a Christian, to think through the claims of Christianity, do go to our website, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable, a vast back catalogue of shows there, and of course links to things like the Unbelievable Conference, the DVD now available. You can find links to that as well as a recent video I put up on the argument from fine tuning called How a Dice Can Show That God Exists. I've got a bit more on that later on today's programme. Something else I'd like to remind you about: if you're a listener to the podcast and you live out on the west coast of the USA, very excitingly, we're having our very first international event. Unbelievable Live is going to be there on Saturday, the 27th of August, in Northridge, California, at Church Every Day. I'll be hosting a dialogue between atheist Ryan Bell and Christian apologist Sean McDowell. Why I'm an atheist and why I'm a Christian. One more information, go to truthmattersministries.com, truthmattersministries.com. I hope you can join me if you're a listener out on the west coast of the USA and you can make it there to Northridge, California on Saturday, the 27th of August. It's going to be a great opportunity for me to meet stateside listeners of the programme and to, of course, engage in a live recording of the programme at the church there. Again, truthmattersministries.com. Time to get into today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, on today's programme, we're discussing the limits of apologetic debate. My guests today, Richard Morgan and Francis Janusz. Richard Morgan is a former atheist, and he actually came back on the show first in 2009, to talk about his conversion to Christianity. He now describes himself as a Richard Dawkins atheist turned, and take a deep breath, evolutionary, apophatic, Catholic fideist. He's a retired teacher driven, he says, by evolutionary forces to use lots of words, just like apologists do, but invited by his beliefs to meet God in silence. We'll find out all about that in the course of the programme. Frances herself is an atheist. She was raised as a Catholic, but abandoned any Christian faith she had after coming to be convinced that there was no good evidence for God's existence. She describes it as C.S. Lewis in reverse. She now works as a lawyer, so she's keenly interested in a purely evidential-based approach for her beliefs. You can find links to both my guests on today's website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Richard's story is told at the Why I'm a Catholic website, and also in a new version of David Robertson's book, The Dawkins Letters. And you'll hear about the David Robertson connection, I'm sure, in the course of the programme. And Francis runs a blog called Counter Apologist Blog as well. Well, Francis and Richard have been friends online for a long time, actually. It was through Unbelievable that they met on the Unbelievable Forum originally. Richard came to me suggesting a show talking about their friendship and the different ways they approach faith and evidence, and particularly what they both see as the limits of apologetics. In fact, both are somewhat sceptical of the effectiveness of apologetics. Perhaps I'll have to come to the defence of apologetics in the course of the discussion myself. But I think it'll prove to be a very interesting discussion. So welcome along, Richard and Francis. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting us.
It's great to have you. I should say that it's rather special for me as well, because we're in a newly refurbished studio for Premier Christian Radio, and this is the first edition of Unbelievable I've been able to record in this particular studio, rather than being all rather more intimately acquainted in one of our very small cubbyhole studios. So it's lovely to have you in.
And we're suitably honoured.
Well, thank you very much. Richard, you've travelled the furthest. You actually live in France, don't you?
Yes, I live in Toulouse in the south of France.
We're, of course, aware of the very sad events of recent times in France. Do, um, uh, do you have friends who have live in the Nice area who may have
been
affected?
Yes, I do have friends and even distant members of the family who live in the Nice itself.
Mm. Well, many people's thoughts and prayers are with the people who've been affected. Your own story is a very interesting one, Richard, because, as I say, you first came on the programme back in 2009 to talk about your conversion. In a nutshell, for those perhaps who won't have heard that programme, you can go back in the archives and find it, but just briefly describe where you were at and what happened to bring you to Christianity.
After having had a brief experience of, shall we say, religion as a Mormon and even as a Mormon missionary in France, I became an atheist upon reading Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker.
Mm.
And at that point, I had an experience similar to France's experience. That is, I discovered I was a default atheist. I didn't believe in God.
Mm.
Because there was no God to believe in. And as I was living in France, I just continued my life, because nobody talks about religion in France. It's a non-subject. There's no theist-atheist debate in France. There's no creationist evolutionary debate. And then I continued to read Richard Dawkins' book with great fascination. You know, I just love the ideas about evolution. And then I discovered that Richard Dawkins himself had created a site, richarddawkins.net, an oasis of clear thinking. I thought, at last I'm going to be able to exchange ideas with other people. Long story short, I was naive. I was ignorant of the real nature of what goes on in online debates. That is to say, most people are basically there to be rude to each other. And the oasis of clear thinking was no different. And what their favourite activity, of course, was to insult Christians and believers of all kinds. And then one day somebody said, have you heard about this guy David Robertson? He's dared to answer Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. And so somebody decided that they were going to read the book so that we could all share the contents without actually having to buy it, and we could criticise it and make fun of it. And I joined in this. I'm not really a very pugilistic person by nature, but I thought, you know, here I am, I'll do as everybody else does. And we started criticising David Robertson's ideas in his book, which was called The Dawkins Letters. And lo and behold, the guy himself turned up under the pseudo of The Weefly.
Yes, that's the tag he goes by on Twitter and
that's right,
elsewhere. Yes.
The Weefly. And he exchanged with us regularly. Every insult we sent out, he would come back and reply. He even at one point posted that he got up so early in the morning that some of the criticisms he received almost made him lose the will to live. And then one of the insults that was levelled at David Robertson was that he was a liar.
Mm.
Okay, he's a liar. And I hadn't seen any clear examples of him being a liar, a deluded fruitcake, certainly, but certainly not a liar. And so I made the mistake of asking people, well, where has he told the lies? And I got insulted for asking the question.
Mm.
Long story short, I realised that in this exchange of insults was not the kind of place that I wanted to be. And I got in touch with David, and I said to him, you know, David, I'm sorry about all the insults that people are levelling at you. I think you're very polite. I can't agree with you, because, quite frankly, I can't believe in God.
Hmm.
At first, he didn't believe me, that it was a serious question. But in the end, he wrote back, and he asked two questions which were to change my life. The first one was, why don't you believe in God? I had a knee-jerk reaction, that's a dumb question. And the second question was, what would make you believe in God? And here was a life-changing moment for me. The answer that came spontaneously was, certainly not proof and evidence. Certainly not proof and evidence. And at that moment, when, as if it were, the intellectual side of my mind was shut down, shall we say, I remembered a verse from the Bible that I learned probably 40 years ago. We love him because he loved us first. And in that moment, my perception of virtually everything changed. Mm. I became a believer at 10:24, the Saturday, April the 12th, 2008.
Yes.
Obviously, I've come a certain distance,
of course,
since then.
Yes. And well, you can fill us in a bit more on the journey since. But I do remember when you came on not too long after that, in 2009, to talk to me with David and another guest about that. And yes, something like an epiphany, I suppose, is what you experienced.
Absolutely, yes.
Others, I think, have suggested at the time, and perhaps you may even have some medical evidence for it now, that you had some kind of brain malfunction. But because you actually have, in fact, been given some scans showing that you have had some mini strokes in the brain.
That's right. Since. I was very thrilled to discover that, because somebody on Richard Dawkins' site said, you know, I think you ought to really seek counselling because it sounds like you've had a temporary brain infarction.
Mm.
In fact, what he was referring to was a TIA or a mini stroke.
Mm.
I didn't really take it seriously at the time. But last year I had some worrying symptoms, things like from time to time I lost orientation, I had problems remembering things, even more serious symptoms like taking presuppositional apologetics seriously. So, you know, I went through phases like that. And when I told my doctor about my listening to Psi 10 Brueggengate, he sent me to have an MR, a brain scan. And on the brain scan image, in fact, there is evidence that I have actually had a series of mini strokes,
right,
which doesn't really have. So, you know,
I suppose it's hard to tell whether that is or isn't related to the epiphany you had, but interesting nonetheless. I mean, beyond all that, what's interesting about your story, in a sense, Richard, is that you obviously engage with apologetics at some level. You listen to Unbelievable. You are interested in talking to other people in the field. But it wasn't in that sense apologetics that brought you to faith. It was very much an experience, a revelation almost of some kind.
I would say that, yes. And in fact, I don't think apologetics brings anybody to faith.
Mm.
I think apologists can create a relationship which will allow people to come to faith.
Mm.
But I think it's been clearly demonstrated by the neurosciences that the intellectual part of the brain is not the part which gives us certainty. There is a part of the brain, as Robert Burton, the neurologist, has shown, a part of the brain much related to the activities of things like love and anger, which give us a feeling of certainty.
Mm, mm.
And this actually probably happens before the neurological network affects what happens with the ideas, the intellectual ideas that we've received and analysed in the prefrontal lobes.
Well, look, we'll come back to you and your experiences and perhaps a bit more of the story so far. Our other conversation partner today, and I think today's show very much is a friendly conversation, much more than a pugilistic debate, as it sometimes is.
Definitely.
Is Francis Janouch. Francis, you have actually been on the programme briefly before, only a month or two back, as a phone guest in a phone-in with Greg Kokel. But it's great to have you in the studio now. And perhaps we could get a little bit more of your background as we've got the time. You grew up in a sort of a Catholic home to some extent?
I would say more a Christian home. It's a little bit complicated. My mother was brought up as a Catholic but lapsed. And I was brought up in the C of E. And then my mother, when I was about 12, decided to give the Catholic Church another try. I had been to a convent school and had become quite fascinated by the rituals surrounding Catholicism and the lives that the nuns led. And so I was attracted to Catholicism and I converted and in fact became a confirmed Catholic when I would have been about 13. And I was a Catholic for not very long, for a few years, and then I started to ask questions. I would describe myself as having always really been an atheist, but I didn't want to be an atheist. Mm. I wanted to believe there was a God, and particularly I wanted to believe that there would be life after death.
Mm.
So I always think of my religious belief, in quotation marks, as being a way in which I stuck my fingers in my ears and sang, la, 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 I can't
right.
hear you.
Mm.
There's a God, there's a heaven.
It was when you sort of ran into people like Bertrand Russell and others that
yes.
you say it sort of blew away the last wisps of what you might have had in terms of a belief in...
That's right. I turned around and I just acknowledged the fact that I'd never really believed it. I'd wanted to believe it. I'd convinced myself that I did believe it, but I'd never really believed it. And it was actually, I suppose it was a bit of a relief not to have to keep up the pretense with myself anymore.
And in a sense, though, you've obviously still engaged regularly on the forums. You run a counter-apologist blog and so on. What keeps you kind of engaged at that level with making the case against religion and faith?
I enjoy an argument. I like analysing things.
You are a lawyer, aren't you?
That's right. Yes, yes. I think that's what attracted me to the law, and it's what attracted me to philosophy, which was my first degree before I qualified for the law. I like to be able to work out where something's gone wrong, if I think it has gone wrong.
Mm.
And I use the same when I'm analysing evidence in a case. Here's the evidence. Here's what we need to prove. Are there any flaws in it? I work for the Crown Prosecution Service, so I'm always working on the prosecution side, but I'm trying to anticipate what the defence may say. How would we poke holes in that? How can we build the case so that we can
so
stop.
It's sort of, it's in your nature then to,
it's
to
I think
that.
It is to look for that argument.
I mean, are you in principle open to being convinced if you found a good enough argument, a good enough evidence? I suppose I'm tempted to ask the same question that brought about Richard's epiphany, which is what would convince you?
What would convince me would be quite difficult for me to describe, because I suppose I would try and approach it by putting, perhaps bouncing the question back to you, what can you imagine might convince you to accept Islam? And I think if I were to ask you that, your immediate response would be probably along the lines, I've already looked into that. I already know what the arguments are, and I know what my answers are.
Mm-hmm.
What could change?
Mm.
And that would be my answer. So if, classic example, I see the God, I am God, written in the stars, then I would ask, why has this not happened before?
Yes.
Why is it happening now?
Yes.
Why is God behaving so out of character, having kept so quiet in the previous millennia? Why is he suddenly doing this? And this seems more like a trick than somebody who has always been there doing something completely different. So that would be the problem, that any evidence that came along would have to answer not only a number of questions, such as the problem of evil, it would also have to explain why the evidence hadn't been there before.
So some apologists do go down the route of seeking to undermine atheism as a valid sort of way of looking at the world, a worldview. Do you have any worries or concerns about, I don't know whether how you'd quite define your atheism anyway, but with the idea that the world is just a purely material phenomenon, that ultimately it's all reducible to matter in motion and so on. Is that what you believe, firstly? And if so, are there any issues with believing that?
I believe that everything that exists either is material or is an emergent property of material things.
Yeah. Is that something you feel you have good evidence for? Or is it something you sort of, at some level, have to eventually say, I'm just going to assume that's the case?
I think there's no evidence for anything more. So I think the evidence is there that material things exist.
Mm-hmm.
I think the evidence is there that they have emergent properties. I don't see any evidence for anything else. And so I stop where the evidence stops.
Richard, you came to not be that convinced that apologetic arguments per se are helpful in actually bringing someone to faith. Where do you see this whole thing lying in terms of evidence? Do you think there is a value in kind of presenting apologetic arguments that might perhaps undermine a materialistic view of the world, physicalist view of the world? Or do you think you've said it's more about, for you, the conversations, the way those conversations happen?
Absolutely. It's the fact of the conversation happening. It's the fact that we're creating and developing a relationship. And as you yourself have said, and Os Guinness has said in the 2014 conference, at the end of the day, the heart, it's all down to the heart. When people are brought to a different understanding or into a relationship with Christ, the apologetic, the argument, can be the pretext, the reason for us being together.
Mm.
But the only experience I've actually had of people coming to belief through apologetics has been a relationship.
Right. You've never seen anyone argued into the kingdom, in that sense, it's sometimes called.
Right. I'm sure it hasn't happened.
I mean, it's interesting because I'm sure I've heard William Lane Craig speak of at least one person he knows who it was really on the basis of an evidential argument that they came to believe. You could even say that C.S. Lewis, he sort of became a theist, I think, in his view, on the basis of essentially something like the moral argument. Now, I suspect that then the further step he took a year or two later to Christianity was also something to do with the emotions and the heart and everything else going on as well.
Right.
So I would say there are people for whom an intellectual argument has played its a definite part.
Yeah, I would like to meet one.
Well, if you're listening and that applies to you, get in touch with Richard. He'd like to meet you. But I guess what I do an apologetics discussion debate show. So I guess I only do it because I think there is a value in these debates. Now, for you, the value seems to be actually just in having the conversation more than trying to convince someone.
Yeah, absolutely, because this is what I think human beings are all about, is the fact of human relationships. It's communication.
Mm.
This is why I think that your show on medieval is such an important one.
Even if you don't think anyone could actually be convinced by the argument that one or the other side is trying to make?
I don't think it matters whether people are convinced or not.
Why do you say that?
Because at the end of the day, we can't get into somebody's heart or mind to know what made them change from one belief to another.
Mm.
We can't ultimately know what their beliefs were to begin with. But we can know that through an exchange, through a discussion, through a relationship, through love, let's say it. The gospel is intensely relational, isn't it? The gospel is all about relationships. The two great commandments talk about love. The Holy Trinity is relational.
I want to talk to you in a minute about where you now find yourself in terms of the way you engage with God and spirituality, Richard. But coming back to you, Francis, what for you is the value of having conversations like the one we're having today or some of the debates you might engage in online and through your blog and so on? What's the value for you in doing that?
I'm afraid I have to be quite superficial and say, for me, the value is just that I enjoy it.
Right.
It's
for fun.
It's for fun, yeah. Yes.
Some atheists I know, do see it as a sort of a moral issue that where I see false reasoning and obviously things being done in the name of religion that they disagree with, that there's a bigger purpose for the online debates they might get into and that kind of thing.
I would like to be able to see it that way, but I can't. I can't persuade myself.
That's very honest.
Moral underlying purpose. I do stand up for certain things, such as I will get quite involved in gay rights arguments, but you don't have to deconvert somebody from Christianity to persuade them to support gay rights. So it's a separate issue.
Sure. Yeah.
And I don't see that. Personally, I don't see a real moral good being done by me if I were ever to deconvert anybody, which I don't think I've ever done in my entire life. But if I did, I wouldn't see it as a moral achievement.
No. So you're not evangelistic necessarily.
Not at all. Not at all. I was saying to Richard that I am not really particularly interested in deconverting Christians. I'm interested in talking to Christians who advance apologetics, who are out there making the argument anyway. Mm. I don't go to Christians. They, in a sense, more come to me. They put themselves out there as having an argument. And I just like the interest. It's a bit like the Times crossword. I just have the interest in trying to pick the argument apart.
Yes. And hence, presumably, why you listen to Unbelievable. You enjoy that sort of debate and discussion on that. Again, though, it doesn't sound like... And you'll forgive me for saying this, I hope, that in a sense you're expecting ever to have your mind changed. It sounds like you've pretty much decided there's really nothing in this apologetics lark. It's not going to...
I think that is
fair. I'm not going to hear an argument that's going to make me change my mind.
I would certainly be quite astonished if I heard an argument that changed my mind. I'm not expecting to. I suppose I think perhaps rather arrogantly that I've looked at it. I've looked at them all.
Right.
They all failed.
No one's going to, unless someone comes up with some radically different thing to what you've heard before.
Quite.
Richard, how are we going to get Francis to become a Christian then?
I have no idea. If you tell me why you wanted to become a Christian, maybe we can look at the approach and the method after that. I want to just add something here, which Francis didn't tell you about, is that I sent her an email in preparation for this programme saying... Do I want to convince you to become a Christian? If so, why? Do you want to convince me to become an atheist? If so, why?
Mm.
And she sent me this beautiful response. She said, if I thought that becoming an atheist could make you happier, I would probably have a different attitude.
Mm.
If I thought, perhaps, probably... This is so full of respect and allowing me my space to be where I am.
Well, that is very nice. We're going to keep talking in a moment's time. We've reached the end of the first part already. Unbelievable today. We're asking, what are the limits of apologetics debate? Richard Morgan and Francis Janusz join me today. Richard, our Christian, Francis, our atheist. And we're having a great conversation here on whether apologetics really can bring people to faith. Maybe we'll explore that a bit more. But also the fact that the conversation, obviously, is very important as well. And we're continuing to dig into these issues. If you want to get in touch yourself about anything you hear on today's programme, do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find us online, of course, at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to our Facebook and Twitter pages and all the rest of the social media, and of course links to Richard and Francis, who join me on today's show. We'll be back in a moment's time. Meet the mission field on your doorstep in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. From happy moral pagans and hipsters to alpha males and atheist memers, we'll introduce you to the new tribes who need to hear the gospel in the UK today. Plus, read our in-depth interview with the UK's former chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, the ethics of boxing and mixed martial arts ahead of this summer's Olympics, post-Brexit news analysis, and practical ways to connect with God in your 9-to-5 job. All that plus news, reviews, and your favourite columnists. Subscribe today or request a free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to part two of today's Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. And we're really talking about the nature of the dialogue and debate today on the programme. We'll be coming back to my guests, Richard Morgan and Francis Janusz, in just a moment's time. Another reminder, you can get in touch as well, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, to send me an email. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/unbelievablejb. Follow me on Twitter at UnbelievableJB. All those links and more available from the Unbelievable website. You can find links there as well to the Unbelievable Conference DVD. If you want to pre-order that, then do go there. But another thing that we're telling you about at the moment is an event I'm going to be hosting in California. Saturday, the 27th of August, I'm going to be at Church Every Day, which is in Northridge, California, hosting a conversation between Ryan Bell, who's an atheist, and Sean McDowell, who's a Christian apologist. This is going to be the very first Unbelievable event we've ever done abroad, so really looking forward to this, and looking forward to seeing how many listeners there are in the California area. And if you can come along, if you can make it to there, it's Northridge, just north of LA. It'd be great to see you. More details from the website. You can, in fact, find more details at truthmattersministries.com, who are kindly hosting this discussion at Church Every Day there. So truthmattersministries.com, or search for Unbelievable Live on the eventbrite.com website, where you can register for the event. So that's Unbelievable Live with me and Ryan Bell and Sean McDowell. Very much going to be sort of in the spirit of what we're talking about today, a conversation where we talk about different faith journeys that have gone in different directions. Why I'm an atheist, why I'm a Christian is what we're titling the discussion, as they discuss faith, reason and the search for truth. And to some extent, that's very much what we've been talking about already on today's programme with my two guests. They are Richard Morgan and Francis Janusz. Richard had a somewhat dramatic conversion to Christianity, an epiphany, back in 2008. He's talked about that actually in years gone by on the show. Today, he describes himself as a Richard Dawkins atheist turned evolutionary apophatic Catholic fideist. Francis is an atheist, was raised with some Christian beliefs and held on to them for some time, but eventually decided that there wasn't good enough evidence for God's existence to believe in God. We've talked to Francis and Richard already about what it might take to believe, what the limits are of apologetics in terms of its ability to kind of, as it were, reason people towards the existence of God. And it would be fun to continue to dig into that a little bit. There may be a couple of words in your self-description there, Richard, which some people are scratching their heads over, particularly apophatic. That's not a word we tend to use every day. When you say you come from the apophatic tradition now, what does that mean exactly?
In fact, it all started on the Unbelievable Forum.
Did it?
Yes.
That's probably the blame for many things in life.
Right, you're going to have a lot to answer for one day. I didn't know it at the time, but I'd been invited to read a book called A Signature in the Cell by Stephen Meyer.
Oh, yes.
A fat volume defending intelligent design through the design of the code in the DNA. Mm. And I read it, and I actually read it twice. And it took me a long time to do so, because I thought I had to be open to this kind of thing. And I made some comments about it. And another person replied to me in just one sentence, and I never came back again. And he said, "God is not a designer."
Hmm.
I thought, oh, what on earth does that mean? The fact that he apparently is involved in design does not mean that he can be defined as a designer.
Mm-hmm.
Designing is what human minds do.
Mm.
I think it's a mistake to project onto God a kind of version of a superhuman being, or a super me, or a super Richard Dawkins.
Mm.
I think it's understandable that we do so, because these are our terms of references. And so I came to the conclusion that whatever we can say about God, well, God is not that.
Okay.
And I discovered there was a word for that. It's called apophatics.
Right.
Thomas Aquinas, I think, developed that by talking about the importance of saying that we can say what God is not. If we can put it into words, then clearly that's not God.
That's very interesting. So this idea of apophatics, in some way suggesting God transcends human categories of definitions, is that sort of the general idea?
Yes, and this is very interesting, because this goes back, doesn't it, to my epiphany experience when I rejected proof and evidence as a way to looking towards God.
Mm. Yes, and so at that level then, do you believe you only really encounter God, I don't know, in a very experiential way? How does someone in that sense then come to know anything about God, I suppose?
Right, I think you've chosen exactly the right word there, experiential. The experience of God. I talk about the experience of God. I don't talk anymore about meeting God. Meeting is what happens between human beings. But an experience of God is when we silence what's going on within our biological selves as much as possible. And we emerge from the prison of all human concepts and we experience something.
It all sounds highly, if you like, subjective, inevitably. Something that it would be hard to show to Francis and say, here's my evidence for God. In a sense, you seem to have abandoned that enterprise at some level, Richard.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Then I suppose, do you even attempt to kind of explain to someone why it would be great for them to be a Christian or anything like that? At what level are you inviting anyone to share in the experience of God that you have been witness to?
Well, first off, I'm a Catholic living in France. You don't go around inviting people to become Christians. But I think that the Pope Francis has said that we start off as evangelism by sharing the joy of the gospel.
Right.
Not convincing brains, but sharing our personal experience of belief, of the love of God, which we can, of course, get a handle on.
And in that sense, where, you know, so you're not here to try and convert Francis today, obviously, but what I suppose I'm just trying to get a handle on where is the connection, then, if it's not showing Francis some sort of evidential apologetics approach, if it's not, you know, where would you begin with, perhaps you haven't met Francis before, would you simply share your story, what happened to you? Would you say, open your mind to this, Francis, and pray a prayer, maybe something will happen? What would be the way you would sort of encourage Francis towards God in that sense?
By love.
That's rather open-ended sort of response.
Absolutely. I did that deliberately. It certainly wouldn't be through, I mean, if I engage in an intellectual exchange with Francis, it's because, one, I respect her as a person. Two, I know she likes this kind of exchange. Three, I know I can learn a lot from her. Now then, what happens as a result of that? I don't want Francis ever to think that I have a hidden agenda. Ooh, I've got to win her for Jesus.
Right. Francis, this is a bit meta, isn't it, talking about the conversations that you sometimes have with Richard and dissecting them in this way. But I guess, do you kind of, you said at the outset that you were more kind of wanted God to exist than actually believed God existed.
Yes.
Do you still, at any level, still want God to exist? That if it's possible that God exists, you'd want that to be the case?
No, not at any level.
So you've lost even that sort of aspect of what you had, the desire for God to exist?
Yes, and I'll be quite honest why. Because I see it. When I try to think about if I became converted, my immediate thought is I would see it as a barrier to the rest of my family.
Okay, so just on a purely sort of familial level, you'd find that very awkward.
Yes.
Right.
And I also would be, if one of my children converted, of course I would support them in a sense, but there, I have to say there would be an experience of disappointment. And again, it would be because I felt that a barrier had come down.
Right.
I didn't raise my children as atheists.
No.
I didn't talk to them at all. I let them attend religious services and religious education lessons. But when, at quite a young age, they asked me something about God or about heaven, I said, some people believe this, Daddy and I don't. You must make your own minds up.
Right. Well, that's good. I mean, you weren't, forcing anything on them in terms of atheism.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But they are now atheists, and I think it would just be a bit awkward, I think.
Sure.
If they...
I mean, if that were to occur, though, you say, of course, you would still love them and unconditionally and so on, but it would just make it difficult to, because there would be a real distinct way in which they approached life from the way you approach life from that point.
That would be different from me. Yeah. I think it would, in some ways, be worse if I were to convert to certain brands of Christianity, because there were certain brands of Christianity in which I came to believe, if I came to believe in them, I would have to believe that my husband and my children and perhaps other members of my family were all going to go to hell, and that would, or even just that they might be snuffed out, whereas I would carry on existing. And I can't imagine anything more terrible than that.
Well, on atheism, that's the view. We'll all be snuffed out while other people carry on existing.
Yes, but then we'll all be snuffed out.
Yes.
I don't have to carry on.
Oh, I see. Right.
I don't have to carry on existing knowing that they've been, they are either suffering or that they've been snuffed out.
Right. Richard, brands of Christianity has been raised, and in a sense, the way you found yourself now is somewhere different to perhaps where you began when you were converted back in 2008. What took you into the arms of the Catholic Church in the end?
Well, it's an interesting story, that. When I had my experience of an understanding of the existence of God, I asked David Robertson, what do I do now? And he got in contact with a pastor in Bordeaux who knew a Reformed evangelical pastor in Toulouse who suggested I went to that church. So I turned up. And lovely man, the pastor, South African. He received me in his home once a week to discuss moving forwards in the faith. And at a certain point, I had to ask him a question. I said, well, how come there are so many different denominations of Christianity? How does one know? I mean, in Toulouse alone, there are more than 50 small groups of Christians which very rarely communicate. And some of them even say that the other groups aren't real Christians. In Toulouse, the Pentecostals say, if you don't speak in tongues, then you're not born again. And I asked him about this, how do I handle this? And he taught me a beautiful lesson, which apparently he has regretted ever since. he went into the broom cupboard and he brought out a long-handled broom. And he held it vertically, and with a brush in the air, he said, put the end in the palm of your hand and try to handle it and try to maintain it in equilibrium.
To balance it
so it didn't fall. So there I was staring upwards at the broom and
doing
I managed to keep
it
there. And he said, now do the same thing, but just by looking at your hand. And of course, within a few seconds, the brush fell to the floor. And he said, this is the problem. We need to look up to Christ in all things. When we start looking horizontally, that is to say, the behaviour of the people, that's when we run into problems. And so I really...
That's a very good little analogy. That I should use that next time.
yes, you're free to do so. And so I thought, well, this is all I can do. Instead of listening to all the variety of voices around me, just turn my view towards God, towards Christ. Christ, the cross, of course. And then a series of events took place, which I think was linked to this change of perspective. Can I tell you about them?
Well, the question is time. So maybe we'll leave that for another day.
Right.
But
just
for that interesting picture analogy, that was really interesting. I suppose my question then is you've come to this position yourself, Richard. Pretty convinced that anyone who does find faith, it's going to be an experiential something. It's a sort of a revelation of kinds, which you can't simply put in a bottle and explain to someone else. Anything we do that does encourage people towards exploring God has to be conversational, full of grace, love, and everything else. Francis is in the position of being one who really requires solid evidence, as far as she's concerned, if she's ever going to put her trust in something like Christianity or faith. And frankly, there's, you know, quite a lot of social barriers as well, by the sounds of it, that would make it have to be really convincing, I suppose, in order to do that. I suppose on my level, in terms of my view of apologetics, I'm sympathetic to you, Richard, because I rarely see people just on the basis of an apologetics argument alone become Christians. I tend to find, you know, and I've said this before on the show, it won't be any surprise to anyone listening probably, but that there's always an answer to every apologetic, you know, argument. You know, numerous ways you can always find, you know, a reason to, you know, which obviously some people say, well, that's not a good reason, but to another person it may seem a perfectly valid reason to reject an argument for God or for Jesus. But for me, I suppose I've always felt someone has to have a sort of intrinsic openness or a willingness to kind of want God almost before an apologetic argument is ever going to lead them in that direction. And I often see the role of apologetics as more for someone who perhaps would walk in the direction of God. Apologetics removes some of the obstacles that might be in the way, some a view of God that's perhaps faulty, or the issue of suffering. And if you give them a few tools to say, well, here's a way to think about that, you might just remove that obstacle and allow them to walk. But it's as though it's the old thing of, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
I think you're missing an important point.
Go on then.
You say you can always, you can give them some tools to see their way through the problem of suffering.
Mm.
Well, that's the whole point. You as a giver, you as a human being reaching out to another human being.
Yeah. Mm.
This
And for you, that's more important than the arguments themselves that you might be presenting.
Absolutely. From my observation of human, an experience of human life, this is what happens. That one person reaches out. I mean, heavens, I've even written a book about it. Mm. The importance, the impact of relationships and opening up, and one person listening to another. The tool you offer may or may not be effective, but the fact that you have offered a tool is an act of generosity, which can have a huge impact on the barriers which could exist in the other person's mind. Keep offering.
Right.
And can I just say that however little I might want to believe in God, the reverse could happen. When I wanted to believe in God, I found I was unable to. If there is a strong argument, however little I might want to, it would be C.S. Lewis, absolutely. And
right.
C.S. Lewis, you remember, described his conversion as, I think, you know, the most unwilling Christian in the whole of history when he fell to his knees. I mean, it is possible. For me, belief is not a choice. Belief is a result of being presented with certain arguments or certain evidence.
Yes. I suppose the problem is, on the current survey you have of the field, no argument and evidence that's currently out there is ever going to come close, I guess, to persuading you.
Not that I've encountered, no.
I mean, what do you think of this statement I said, that I do think that, to some extent, there's no argument that could be proffered which couldn't have some rebuttal at some point. And so there's a sense in which, I suppose, if as long as there's always a reply to an argument, do you feel then, at what level would an argument need to be kind of a cast iron 100% proof? Is there anything that, you know, do you at least regard some arguments as better than others, even if none of them actually finally convince you? And is there a level at which you would say, well, that gets me about 80% of the way there, but I'd need to be at 99% to kind of actually say, no, this has actually made me change my mind?
I think that of the arguments I know of, I am most given pause for thought by the fine-tuning argument. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately it doesn't work, although I say that with some caution because I'm not a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And so in assessing the argument, I tend to drop back and look at how scientists react to these features about the beginning of the universe. And I don't see a lead from those scientists in the direction of this, therefore, supports God. I would be very slow to strongly go along with a scientific argument either way, because I can't assess it right for myself. I have to rely on how other people who know science better than me assess it. So I wouldn't, I think, be very quick to say that science had disproved God.
Yeah.
And I certainly am not inclined to say that science has proved God, although that was the argument that convinced Anthony Flew, who was my professor of philosophy at Reading.
Oh, well, that's an interesting little point there. In a sense, he's a classic example many people point to of someone who was willing to change his mind in the end. Now, there was some debate over, some people suggested, oh, well, he went a bit senile in his old age and that sort of thing. But he personally, and I know because I did have a brief phone conversation with him at the time, I tried to get him on the show. It never happened in the end. But he certainly didn't appreciate that sort of those motives being attributed to him. But regardless of all that, I guess there's a classic example for you, Richard, a counterexample to your view that arguments never do make people change their minds about God. Well, in Anthony Flew's case, apparently it was. It was the fine-tuning of the universe argument that made him think, actually, yeah, there's enough evidence for design here for me to say there is a God. Now, he didn't become a Christian. No one's claiming that. But he did become a theist, as far as we're aware.
As you say, as far as we're aware. We're not inside his mind. We weren't inside his mind.
And so are you saying there may be all other kinds of factors that we're not factoring in?
I'm saying there are almost certainly other kinds of factors that we're not factoring in, yes.
Yeah. We're going to be starting to draw things to a close in this section, but again, I do want to come back to this thing, Francis, of what would convince you, because I'm sympathetic almost to why Richard has abandoned any hope of using apologetic arguments if you're you know the person that he's next to, because I can see that you've got a very incisive mind, but I don't know, at some level I think that if the standard that the level of evidence you need is almost going to be impossible for anybody to present, because when we deal with God, we're not dealing with something like a physical thing or a body that's been murdered or anything else that you might see in your it's something that is far more underneath all of that or above all of that or whatever you want to use, whereas it sounds like you want to be able to show that God exists in the way that a scientist could show that the Higgs boson particle exists or something like that. Is that the kind of type of evidence for God you'd need in that sense?
I think it would. There would be nothing wrong with evidence of that type. I think I'm not very good at the Old Testament, but I think there is one of the Old Testament stories is about God lighting a fire when the other gods can't light a fire. Now, that seems to me to be quite a good piece of empirical evidence, but we just don't see a lot of it around these days. But if it was felt to be good then, why can't we see more of that? Why can't we see that through history? I don't see anything wrong with it being that type of evidence, but an alternative would be arguments, use of logic, or just more generally abductive arguments. I just don't find any of them satisfactory. If there was a strong argument presented to me, what I imagine I would do is go away and try and pick holes in it. And probably, as you say, you can pick holes in something. But I think it would be, if I were ever to be persuaded, it would be a slow process, as being unpersuaded was a slow process. It would be something that perhaps would niggle, and I would think, well, although I've found this flaw, is it a real flaw, or is it something that is just that I'm just making objections for the sake of it?
If you had, let's imagine, an epiphany of the sort that Richard had. Now, it's hard to say what your response to that would be, because you know, an epiphany by definition is something that sort of changes your entire worldview. But would you be? We did this. I don't know if you've managed to listen to the program yet, but we did a conversation just a week or so back with a young lady, Vanessa James, who had gone through the process of deconversion, become quite a happy atheist, and then the surprise in the story was she had this extraordinary experience, not dissimilar perhaps to something like what Richard describes, something that she said went beyond evidence, logic and reason, and just made her believe there is a God by the power of this experience that she had. She's still working through that as to whether that will take her all the way back to Christianity. But would you be naturally sceptical of anything like that, because it could just be a mini stroke in the brain producing an effect like that?
I would. I cannot imagine myself relying on a personal experience of that sort to deduce anything about the existence of something outside the experience.
You are, in a sense, always, though, relying on your brain at one level for your atheist beliefs. You know, you are a product of your brain. So in a sense, you can't get away from the fact that it's the stuff going on in there that's making us believe the things we do believe, can we?
Yes, but I suppose I don't see that as a problem. I mean, I know that if I have an experience, whatever the experience is, I know that I've had the experience. In terms of attributing it to something, I then look for evidence. So, for instance, if I experience the taste of pineapple, I can then look for evidence. Well, there's a pineapple, or, you know, I've got some pineapple in my mouth. If I just experience the taste of pineapple and I'm not eating a pineapple, and it's not that somebody has wafted the smell of pineapple under my nose, then all I can say is I had an experience of the taste
something.
Of pineapple.
Yeah,
but I don't say there must be a sort of spiritual pineapple that I encountered.
Why for you was it not just a taste of pineapple that you experienced, Richard, when you had your moment? Why for you did it convince you?
I have no idea.
We get this a lot from you, Richard, don't we? I don't know. I don't know. I've no idea.
it was something that happened to me.
Yeah.
Yes, obviously I've thought about that a great deal since, particularly since having the brain scan, as you can imagine. And at the end of the day, I find that we're discussing this in the bus on the way here. In a sense, I do choose to believe, because in my moments of doubt and despair, I can look in one direction and feel greater despair, and I can look in another direction and feel hope.
Right.
And this is so tremendously important to me that this begins to lift me up.
Right.
I don't feel the need to prove that God exists. I mean, as a Wittgensteinian, I would have to define what existing means, and I'm certainly not going down that rabbit hole. I was really struck by something that I read from Thomas Merton, of whom you've no doubt heard, who said, "There is no such thing as God because God is not a thing."
Yes. Well, that was the very title of a book, again, a couple of months ago now, by Rupert Short, God is No Thing, which very much, I think, again, from a Catholic perspective, maybe this is particularly from the apophatic tradition, suggests that we cannot categorise God in the way we categorise physical things, within existence, when God at some level is the source of all that is. But we'll come back to all this. We've got to go to another quick break, and we'll be back with the final thoughts from my two guests. We're talking about the limits of apologetics today. Richard Morgan and Francis Janusz joining me, Justin Briley, for Unbelievable, bringing you conversations that matter every week. Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley. This is the programme that brings conversations between Christians and non-Christians to your earphones if you're listening via podcast, to your radio if you're listening this Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. And don't forget that the profile follows today's programme. Sam Hales is going to be speaking to Peter Gladwin. He's got the most amazing story of a life turned around from gambling and alcohol, and how he found Christ. So listen out for that between 4 and 5 this afternoon. If you're coming back next week for Unbelievable, then we're going to be hearing the first of two shows in which Gary Habermas, who joined us for this year's Unbelievable, the conference, is going to be in dialogue with Michael Roos, who's an atheist philosopher out in the States. Always great fun with Michael. He's a really sort of jovial character, and him and Gary are going to be talking about naturalism, whether an atheistic account of naturalism makes sense, and also miracles in a second show. So that's really worth tuning in for at the same time next week, or picking up on your podcast, depending on how you listen. We will be hearing some of your feedback in a moment's time, as well as the audio of a video I released a couple of weeks ago now, but that premiered at our conference. And that's a video called How a Dice Can Show That God Exists. And we've had lots of interesting feedback to it, lots of shares of the video on Facebook especially. I'll be playing out the audio, and if you want to go and watch the video, you're very welcome to do that. It's up at the front page of the Unbelievable website. But we'll get to all that after we finish today's conversation between Richard and Francis.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So as we conclude today's conversation on the limits of apologetics and apologetics debate, my guests have been Richard Morgan and Francis Janusz. Richard is a former atheist who became a Christian, and he's described in some detail today that journey for him, which really wasn't one that involved a sort of rigorous arguments compelling him towards the conclusion that God exists and Christ rose from the dead. Rather, it was an immediate epiphany of sorts that brought him to faith. Frances is an atheist. She has been hot on the trail of the evidence for God most of her life, but she says she's never found anything to convince her. But Richard and Frances are good friends. They met through the Unbelievable Forum. Despite living in different countries, they still regularly engage with each other. And Richard, for you, as you've been highlighting throughout this conversation, for you it's not about the apologetics per se, it's about the conversation that apologetics can be instrumental in bringing about, and for you that's far more important than whether your arguments are good, watertight or sound. And that kind
not only is it far more important, it's that which is transformative. Is that an English word? It's that which can transform people in bringing them to a higher sense of happiness within their life, giving them a sense of meaning. It's all down to relationships, in the sense.
Is there any point to apologetics itself, then? I mean, we could be talking about anything today. You know, we could have a politics show, we could have ethics show, or whatever. You know, something interesting to talk about. Is there any point to apologetics in specifically, Richard?
I think there are three points for apologetics. I think the first one is that it's certainly, to a large array of Christians, it makes them feel more confident within themselves. Those Christians who feel the need to confront philosophical arguments against Christianity, they feel stronger. Therefore, they are more courageous in proclaiming the gospel, if you were. And if only for that, even if their arguments are wrong, I think the fact that they have this confidence, I think that is a good thing. The second thing is that, as you say, apologetics, whilst apologetic discussions are happening, the discussion is happening. We can't ignore the fact that it's within a God context. It's not within a political context. It's within the context of the gospel. It's within the context of a gospel of love and salvation. So it's not irrelevant, the fact that it's just about religion.
You tend to, though, avoid those sort of quite full-on debates that go on the pages very often in the Unbelievable group on the Facebook page. And to be honest, I tend not to get too involved myself. I often find these interactions, in a sense, far more productive at the end of the day than the endless Facebook comments. But like me, Richard, you probably put your head in your hands when you see the way some Christians nevertheless do interact with atheists and vice versa in these forums.
Not anymore.
No?
No, I made this sad discovery a long time ago that we're all human beings. And I realised that this kind of thing was going to happen.
The internet got invented and we all continue to act like humans.
Exactly.
Yeah. What do you think there's any value in apologetics, Francis?
Yes, I think there's always value in talking about your reasons for taking any position. I think that it reflects a human need to justify yourself and to justify any stance you take. It does reflect a wish to communicate with other humans, which is also valuable.
Yeah. You don't want God to exist.
No.
You'd have to have a pretty much cast iron proof of God to accept that he does exist. And even a dramatic epiphany-like sensation or experience wouldn't convince you. You'd be sceptical, or would hope to be sceptical.
Looking at it from my position now, I can't imagine being anything other than sceptical. But I can't say, because if I had that experience...
Yes, you'd never know what you might feel.
I don't know how it will change me.
Sure. I once invited people to atheists to take part in an atheist prayer experiment.
Yes, I remember.
You may have listened to that one. And that was very interesting, because I really respected people who were willing to sort of stick their neck out and say, OK, God, if you're there, I'm going to send up this prayer. I feel a bit silly, but here we go. And it's impossible to tell how actually openly people did that or not. You know, you're simply going on what they tell you. Is that the kind of thing you would ever feel you'd want to do? I mean, are you willing to kind of, beyond the debates, sort of say, if you're there, God, let me know every so often?
I suppose the truth is I'm not much motivated to try.
Exactly.
That.
That's what I was wondering.
Yes.
It's almost like, because you don't want God to be there, is there a sense in which, well, I'm not going to go actively looking in that sense for God?
I think that's an unfair question.
Okay.
It's not that she doesn't want God to be there. She doesn't want the God that has been represented to her.
Ah, okay. Well,
to be there, which is entirely different.
Well, there might be something... There might be something in that. There might be something in that that Richard's just said. I would find it difficult to believe in the God of the Bible. My perspective is that I don't believe in or respect the God of the Bible. Another way, a God who I might find more sympathetic, well, that could be a different question, but it's not one that I tend to address my mind to.
Sure.
I find it very difficult to envisage sitting down or kneeling down and saying, God, if you're there, I'm open to you. And really wanting to get a positive answer or thinking anything other than, you know, this is just too silly for words,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
I feel such a fool.
Well, fine, and thank you for the honesty in that. I guess it brings me back to my feeling that in the majority of cases where people do find God, perhaps apologetics might be part of that journey, there is a sort of an openness to, in principle, wanting there to be a God. And I know, even in the C.S. Lewis example, where he said he was the most reluctant convert in the whole of England, I think there was still a level at which Lewis was compelled towards that belief, because it was worse having a universe with no hope and no justice and no morality, almost. So I almost feel like there was still a sense in which he wanted there to be a God, because otherwise the universe just seemed too much of a nihilistic kind of void in the end. Those are just my thoughts on it. I feel like often, in the vast majority of cases where I see conversions occur that have apologetics involved at some level, there's a kind of a desire on the part of an individual to be grasping towards God. And because I don't think anyone who wants to reject God, I always feel, well, you will never get enough evidence for that, you know, that would unwillingly compel you, as it were, to belief in God. I feel like there's always, you know, you can always find an answer to any apologetic argument.
There are atheists who will say, I would like God to exist. I've
yes,
certainly
and
seen
I've,
that.
I've met some of them. Yes, absolutely.
But I can't I can't pretend to be one of them.
We're all different. It's been really fun and interesting meeting you, Frances. I hope perhaps you can join me in the studio again at some point in the future. Richard,
that would be great.
A bit harder for you. You're based in France most of the time, but if you're over again, it'd be lovely to see you. Thank you very much for suggesting today's conversation. It's been very interesting.
Thank you very much, Justin.
Thank you for having us.
And if you want more on Richard, you can find him his story at the Why I'm a Catholic site. David Robertson's fresh version of the Dawkins Letters, revised version, has a little bit by Richard in it as well. And a counter-apologist blog is where you can find Frances blogging. All of those links and more available. We'll try and link back to Richard's first appearance on the programme as well from today's website. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Tell people about Unbelievable. Why should people listen to Unbelievable, Richard? What's kept you listening faithfully for, well, a long time now?
I haven't. I just listen from time to time.
Well, that's fine as well. That's fine.
Right.
It's great that you have, you know, been able to sustain these relationships and these interesting conversations during that time.
I also think you do a very, very good job.
Well, thank you very much.
I can say that I listen every week.
I've got one faithful listener, at least.
Yeah, I never miss an opportunity because I think that the quality of guests you have on and the range of opinion you reflect is fascinating.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Frances. I really appreciate that. Thank you for listening as well. If you want to get in touch, again, I'll be giving the ways to do that in a moment's time. For the moment, Richard Morgan and Frances Janusz were my guests today on the programme, and I hope you've enjoyed today's conversation.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you want to get in touch, don't forget, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address, or feel free to message me via the Facebook or Unbelievable Twitter handle as well, at UnbelievableJB, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. Want to talk to you about this dice video that I've been mentioning. Before that, a few people got in touch about last week's programme. That was a highlights reel, if you like, of the Unbelievable conference from a few weeks ago, and encouraging you to get hold of the DVD and MP3 CD if you want to hear the full thing. Stephen on Facebook says, I guess I'm going to have to order the Unbelievable DVD now. I was enjoying the segments in the programme, really getting into them, and then they'd get cut off. I was like, Justin, stop interrupting. Really good, though. It would have been nice to be there. Glad it went so well. Well, you've got the idea, Stephen. I whetted your appetite with those little segments from the various talks, and in the hope that it might persuade one or two people at least to go and pick up the full DVD. That's available. You can find, again, a link from the Unbelievable webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Robert asks, interested in purchasing a copy of the DVD, but as we live in the US, wondering if there are any plans for a digital download option in the future. Any chance of that? No plans for that at the moment, Robert, so you will have to get hold of the DVD, and I'm afraid, yes, it does involve a bit of a shipping cost as well on top of the normal price. Let's talk about this video. I released a video a couple of weeks ago now on the back of showing it for the first time at Unbelievable, the conference. My attempt really to give an analogy, a layperson's analogy of the evidence for God from the fine tuning of the universe. And I did this through talking about a dice, or a die it should specifically be, but most people talk about dice even when they're talking about the singular. Here's the audio from the video, and you can find the video at the webpage of Unbelievable. For those who haven't been able to see the video yet, here's what I said, and we'll hear some of the responses to that video in a moment's time.
Some people say that human existence is a result of a roll of the cosmic dice. Like the gambler who stakes his life savings on the next throw, we just got lucky in the lottery of life. Some people say there's no purpose in the universe, no grand plan, no God behind it all. Our numbers just came up and here we are. But I don't believe them, and nor should you. If I roll this dice, the chances of getting a 6 is 1 in 6. That's not too bad. But what are the chances of me rolling 6 twice in a row? Well, the odds get longer. It's 1 in 6 times by 1 in 6. That's 1 in 36. So I'd have to be pretty lucky to get 2 6s in a row. Now, every time I add the chances of rolling another 6 in a row, the odds go up exponentially, and it gets even more unlikely. Now, what if I rolled this dice 70 times and every single time I got a 6? Okay, that's pretty unlikely, but it's possible, right? Well, in fact, the chances of rolling a 6 70 times in a row are around 1 in 10 to the 55. That's a 1 with 55 zeros after it. Now, just to put that in perspective, how long would I have to stand here rolling this dice, allowing about 5 seconds per roll, before hitting that lucky streak and rolling 70 sixes in a row? Well, I had a mathematician friend work it out for me. On average, you would have to continually roll this dice for 100 trillion, 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 trillion years before your numbers come up. That's a long time. What if you applied that thinking to us? What are the odds of us being here? Now, the odds of rolling 76 in a row, 1 in 10 to the 55, as it happens, those are the same odds of something called the expansion rate of the universe being just right for the existence of us here today. From the moment of the Big Bang, when our universe began to rapidly expand, the rate of that expansion was exquisitely finely balanced. Any faster, and the universe would have expanded too rapidly to allow the formation of chemicals, atoms, stars, and galaxies. Any slower, and the universe would have collapsed back in on itself. But as it happens, the universe expanded at just the right rate to allow for life to develop in the future, for us to be here. It hit 70 rolls of the number 6 in a row, first time. And the expansion rate of the universe is just one among 30 or so other incredibly sensitively finely tuned constants and fundamental forces in the universe that must be just the way they are for the universe to be able to produce us. So let's imagine, if I went ahead and rolled this dice 70 times, and what do you know, every time it came up 6. No waiting for trillions upon trillions of years. First time. Beginner's luck? Hardly. You would assume that I must have rigged it. Maybe the dice are loaded. Maybe there are sixes on every side. It can't be chance. Now let me ask you, why would we assume that this universe with us in it, which is actually way more improbable than my 70 rolls, is just a result of chance? The fact that we're here shows that someone's loaded the dice. In fact, maybe there's no dice at all. What if the evidence points to this life-permitting universe actually being the product of an intelligent mind which intended for us to be here? Now, you could come up with some speculative other theory. Maybe there's an infinite number of universes giving you an infinite number of chances to roll the dice. Maybe. But we don't have any scientific evidence for it. So if you're hanging your hat on that possibility, then you're every bit as much committed to a faith position as the person who says God was behind it. Believing in God isn't a delusion. It's a perfectly reasonable conclusion when we look at the fingerprints on our universe. And if it's true that we aren't just the fluke result of a cosmic roll of the dice, and that we're actually here because a grand designer intended us from the very beginning, well, that's worth staking something on.
There you go. That was the audio from a video that's been doing the rounds. It had, at the last count, over 85,000 views, actually, on Facebook, where it's doing particularly well, and several thousand on YouTube as well. You can find it, if you want to watch it, share it, and so on, at the webpage of Unbelievable, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to the YouTube version, or indeed share it from the Facebook page of Unbelievable. Do it that way. But inevitably, lots of atheists and skeptics who disagree with the way I've put things across there. People like Jeff, who's emailed in, and sorry, I can't read the email out, not really time, Jeff, but quibbling with the probabilities and the dice rolls and so on. Others like Skydive Phil, who's going to be on the programme actually in September, with an objection to the example of the expansion rate of the universe, which he thinks has been shown not to be really fine-tuned. So I'll try and find time to get some response to that. We're going to be looking at the fine-tuning argument again, and multiverse theory as well. a bit later on in the year. So that might be a good chance to properly look at this. But thanks for all those who have shared the video, enjoyed it, or indeed objected to it. That's all part of the fun, isn't it? Let's go to some of your emails regarding the last couple of shows. Maybe specifically the one in which we did the ex-Christian and the ex-atheist. That was Vanessa James as the ex-Christian, who'd had this extraordinary story, not only of losing her faith, becoming an atheist, but then sort of coming back to some kind of a belief in the supernatural through an extraordinary vision experience she described on that programme. And Holly Ordway was our ex-atheist, who's now a Christian, in conversation with Vanessa. This from Arnold says, enjoyed the show. Nice to have two female guests. I was struck by the way the ex-atheist, Holly Ordway, kept saying feel and felt during her story. Reminded me of a story in the New York Times a few weeks ago. It talks about people who say feel a lot as unconsciously using motivated reasoning to themselves and others when dialoguing. The flip side of the coin being people who use the word I think instead of I feel in conversation, who appear to be more objective and capable of changing their minds if given suitable reasons. Kyle S. says, howdy Justin, terrific conversation with Vanessa James and Holly Ordway. Had one of those moments of, holy cow, I'm not the only one who feels this way, when Vanessa talked about seeing good arguments on both sides and not knowing where to come down. Holly's very reasonable response reminded me of a Rush lyric. If you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice. I think making the choice to keep an open mind, as Vanessa has, is a pretty solid one. Thanks for another great show. And you say you'd love to be there at the Sean McDowell, Ryan Bell discussion in America, but it'd be quite a hike from New York. No, I'm not expecting you to fly over from New York, Kyle. Jay says, I wanted to comment on the no true Scotsman thing. This is the idea that some people say of an ex-Christian, oh, you were never really a Christian in the first place. I do believe that we can't say that no Christian would about individual actions, because everyone struggles with sin at varying degrees. However, I do believe that you can't lose your salvation. I don't believe the Bible teaches that. Back to my point, I think it's ironic or contradictory for an ex-Christian, quote unquote, to argue against the statement that if you fall away, you were never a Christian to begin with, because they obviously don't believe Christianity is true. So they would agree to an extent that they were never a Christian, because the basis of Christianity is false. I hope that makes sense. I know what you mean, Jay. In a technical sense, yes, I suppose you could say of the ex-Christian, well, you were never a Christian because, well, you don't believe Christianity is true, so you can't have been a Christian. But I think to all intents and purposes, one could say, I was a Christian. I believed then in all those things which I now don't believe in, if you see what I mean. But yeah, I take your point. Bevin says, I've been listening to Unbelievable for a number of years now on the podcast while running a lawn mowing and gardening business down here in Tauranga, New Zealand. I hope I've pronounced that. I thought I have to contact you one day to let you know I'm listening, how much I appreciate your dialogues. I think this is the perfect opportunity. I was inspired by the Holly Ordway and Vanessa James discussion. I sympathise with Vanessa a lot, but came to a very different conclusion. A little over 2 years ago, my wife and young family left the charismatic church after coming to the discovery that much of what it teaches deviates from the historic Christian faith and is only a very recent phenomenon that differs quite drastically at times from historic Christianity. And that can be heard in Vanessa's testimony. She said she was an incredibly passionate Christian, but unfortunately I heard nothing about her trusting in Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of her sins. I don't remember ever hearing any allusion to the work of what Christ accomplished, the heart of Christian faith. Instead, it seemed to center around atmospheres of experience and hype. This, I believe, is a testament to the faith destroying and works-based practices of the charismatic church, a performance-driven environment proclaiming and striving after promises that Jesus never made. So no wonder people give up. I don't blame them any more than I blame a Jehovah's Witness or Mormon for giving up under the pressure of a performance-based religion. But as I've said above, I came to a very different conclusion than Vanessa and now attend a non-denominational Reformed church. From what I recall, you've never had a show discussing coming out of the charismatic church. This is a big phenomenon these days, and more church leaders are speaking out against the fundamental errors in charismatic churches. Thank you very much, Bevin. That would be an interesting one to do. I can't say I completely agree with you. I think personally, my view on the charismatic church is you get extremes, which are not helpful. But most charismatic churches I know in are very gospel centered as well. They would not shy away from preaching and teaching on the forgiveness of sins through Jesus. It's just that they are also open to charismatic gifts of the Spirit. Of course, you do get extremes where people chase after experiences and so on instead of centering on the gospel. But thank you very much for that. And for everyone else who's been in touch, no time to read any more emails for the moment. Loads of great shows still to come on Unbelievable this summer. Going to be hearing from people like Beth Grove and Jay Smith on their ministry to Muslims at Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park. Is believing in God a properly basic belief? Going to be hearing a debate between Stephen Law and Tyler McNab on that philosophical issue. And of course, really looking forward to airing this conversation with TV illusionist Derren Brown that I was able to have with him a few weeks ago. So lots to look forward to, and of course what we're doing on the show next week.
You're unbelievable.
Christian philosopher and New Testament historian Gary Habermas joins me for the first of two programmes where he interacts with atheist philosopher Michael Ruse. Next week we're going to be asking whether atheist naturalism is a coherent worldview. Hear that discussion between two eminent guests and join me, Justin Brierley, for the show that aims to get you thinking every single Saturday. Until then, have a great week and I'll see you next time. The Profile's here next with Sam Hales.